From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
I didn't want to, you know, be a bad kid in school, so the easier option just lay under the knife.
A large mocha's actually now passed the €6 threshold, and like I always
€6.
Yeah, I always think of, you know, €4. Kind of, God, that's very expensive for
a coffee.
Don't
buy mochas now. I don't even know what they are.
And it was also a time for foretelling the future, but protecting yourself from any evil influences, especially the evil eye.
Coming up on this special May Day edition of Playback Daily, the lying lies that liars tell. How much? Why your coffee keeps getting dearer. And careful now, there's more to May Day than you think. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that has two evil eyes, just in case. Let's begin the show today with Oliver Callan musing on the things in the media that caught his attention, one of which was the welcome return of the Luke Kelly Festival to Dublin.
Luke Kelly died 40 years ago this year. January was his anniversary, and Dublin City Council and the people involved in celebrating Luke Kelly's life delighted to announce that there's going to be a festival. The Luke Kelly Festival will return to Dublin after its successful debut last year. So who's going to be in this festival? It's happening this very month on the 18th and 19th of May. So mark it off in your calendar. Mary Black, Lisa O'Neill, Phelim Drew, the Dublin Legends, Fiddlemaster Kevin Burke and local folk artists will be performing in Smithfield Square. Good to see use of Smithfield Square actually in this particular way for the arts. But they're delighted to have him back. There's a nephew being quoted here, Luke McCann. He's Luke Nelly's nephew. Delighted, the family says, to see the festival coming back for another year. And it's also going to offer something to those who want to learn more about Luke Kelly and the Dubliners and Dublin and the era that they came from. He died, of course, January 1984, would you believe? So Dublin City Council are involved in that, and they've announced that. Donald Fallon, the historian and host of the Three Castles Burning podcast, a deadly podcast, will also be on site chatting to Phelim Drew and Brian Hand about their memories of the Dubliners and the Luke Kelly Festival. Yes, 12 to 6pm on the 18th of May. And you're going to love this because children can also get involved. There's going to be a dedicated football area at the Luke Kelly Festival in Smithfield called the Centre Half. Why? Because Luke Kelly was a fan of the football, he was. So a rare old Dublin moment there that you can enjoy. Yeah, yeah. You have to get your smoky voice out for that one and enjoy the Dubliners. Yeah. Yeah, pox. You're allowed to say that at Luke Kelly Festival.
Steady on there, Oliver. Let's swiftly move along to happy news for sister station Lyric FM.
Congratulations to our colleagues on RT Lyric FM turning 25. Nearly didn't make it there for a while, didn't it? There was all that unpleasantness a couple of years ago. So we are extra delighted that they get to celebrate their 25th anniversary. It was switched on 12 noon on the 1st of May 1999 and has continued to grow in popularity over the 25 years. What are they going to do to celebrate it? They're having a gala concert. Everyone else just has a concert, but if you're Lyric, you get to call it a gala concert. Oh, yes, indeed, Marty Whelan. We can make fun of Marty because he's on air right now. Oh, yes, Lyric FM nearly didn't do it. But he'll soon have his moustache bristled with Baileys very soon. So it's a great month for Marty when he gets to Eurovision. So, the gala concert in Limerick, the home of, yes, Lyric FM. I thought I said Lyric and Limerick and got them all confused. Lyric lives in Limerick. Not me. No. Don't go down there. Very rare. But the concert features the RTÉ Concert Orchestra, conducted by David Brophy, host of performers and Lyric presenters. But it is totally sold out, if you're thinking of making your way there. But you can join the fun, join the party, 7:30 this evening, live on Lyric FM. No word that their new fan, Sarah Jessica Parker, whether she will turn out or not.
I had a feeling that Sarah Jessica Parker would get a look in there. Happy birthday to Lyric and all who sail in her. Meanwhile, sad news coming from the world of condensed reading.
Reader's Digest. Dentist waiting rooms and the lounges of provincial guest houses will never be the same again because Reader's Digest magazine is no more. This was the US-based monthly magazine. I always thought it was British for some reason. I don't know why I thought it, but it was an American magazine. Had at one point the largest circulation of any periodical in the world. It was first published over here. It was obviously big in America from the 20s, but it didn't make it to Ireland and Britain until the year that Hitler marched into Austria. And the ballpoint pen was invented the same year, which, as it puts Riley here in the article I'm reading in a British newspaper, could only be within the pages of the now not so venerable Reader's Digest magazine that both of those events would be given roughly equal weighting. That's right, they did kind of jam random bits of information together, just huge, important global moments with sort of innocuous trivia. So administrators have been called in to chew over the magazine that was once the byword for the cosy, comforting and borderline soporific in the publishing industry. Always sad to see these kind of big institutions depart. Never fully really understood it. It was like kind of bits of stuff rather than anything complete. It's not Reader's Digest. Speaking of the reading world, interesting information, a report commissioned about young adult fiction, YA fiction or YA fantasy fiction, YAF, as some publishers might call it. Apparently young adult fiction, such as The Hunger Games, A Good Girl's Guide to Murder, the Heartstopper graphic novels, you know that area, usually aimed at teenagers. But research has shown that more than a quarter of the readers of young adult fiction in the UK and Ireland are over the age of 28. What's going on here? Growing numbers of adult readers reading these kind of young people's teenage fiction since 2019. 74% of more than three quarters, 74% of young adult readers are adults, 28% over the age of 28. Yes, I get it now. And they think it's due to behavioural changes in our world in general, emerging adulthood. This is where young people, you know, are growing up more slowly and putting off adult life. And particularly in this country, you can see why they'd have to put off adult life. They've no choice because they're living with their mammies in the box room. The feelings of instability, the in-betweenness has led to young adults seeking solace in young adult teenage fiction. And for some of these books remain a source of comfort as they grow older. There's the other problem as well. If you're a fan of Philip Pullman's brilliant young adult fiction, his Dark Materials, of course, and Sally Lockhart Mysteries, he complains that there should be no age restrictions. There should be no kind of dividing up of the bookshop of this is for, you know, 7 to 9 year olds and this is young adult fiction, and so adults don't enter here. Because young adult fiction, it can be quite brilliant, not just for kids, and the publishers unfairly treat books and try to put them into these categories. Teenagers and kids should read adult books, adult fiction, and also adults should read material that's aimed at the younger readers. You'll find out more about the other generation if you look at it from that way.
Yeah, another way of looking at things is not what the 2020s are about, I suspect. But fair play to Oliver for suggesting it. Finally, in musings from this morning, the scandalous Jerseygate that's happening in GAA land.
So this is a phenomenon that's apparently unique to the GAA, which we'll come to in a moment. The surge in torn jerseys. What is going on in matches? So the ball's running in Ulster Championship game there just a week before last. Donegal Derry. Donegal's Kieran Thompson came on wearing number 32. But on the match programme, he was down as number 8. What happened? By all accounts, his own jersey had been torn by his own teammates during the warm-up. And when their side played Kerry in the league in March, Galway's Paul Conroy fell victim to the infamous collar rip, a relatively new battle tactic involving players grabbing the collar of an opponent, forcefully yanking it downwards in a clear and obvious attempt to destroy the garment. It also happened in Tyrone versus Kerry as well. In the league, Peter Hart and David Clifford both had their jerseys torn in the match. And Lee Keegan, who infamously had his jersey torn in the draw in 2016, he had a tussle with Dermot Connolly. I think they both ended up, it was Dermot Connolly's jersey ripped open from his collar to the midriff. Lee Keegan's talking about, I think teams or players have the idea that it's a tough image or a macho approach, but it takes the focus off on what you're supposed to be doing. And in many cases, does it give the individual or the collective an advantage? I'm guessing very few. And Adam Moynihan is wondering what's going on. Is it to do with the quality of the jerseys? O'Neill's did not respond to a request for comment. So he went to a renowned kit designer, Rob Warner, who was talking about that shirt pulling, common in soccer and rugby, but he's never come across players actually going out to destroy their own team's apparel intentionally. So he thinks it's unique to the GAA. And he's saying that a lot of the shirt manufacturers, the Gansey makers, wouldn't necessarily test it for intentional destruction. They're more about, you know, they use fabric for the attributes good for keeping players cool, comfortable, flexible. But when it comes to tear strength, it's not robust for that kind of thing at all. So you might be wondering, is it light material? What is going on in the GAA? But that's what's going on. They could consider doing what's happening in the AFL. A fellow called Devon Robertson recently had his jersey completely torn to shreds, ripped in a tackle. And instead of scampering off to the sideline for a replacement, he just played on with a shirt hanging on by a thread, eventually whipped it off, flung it away in dramatic fashion, and he continued to play on, naked from the waist up, leading to a surprised commentary on Australian television. I think you'd only get away with this kind of thing in Australia. And his Instagram followers shot up as a result of his topless display. And but they might. The good news is that Devin Robertson, he sold his ripped up jersey at auction, raising thousands for a cancer charity. So it ended well. I don't think he'd be allowed to play topless in the GM. I mean, it was scurrilous. The Australians, many years behind us emotionally.
RTE would like to apologise to all our Australian listeners. That's not an apology. This is an apology. I'm so sorry. Now that we've annoyed an entire nation, we can call it a day for Wednesday's Oliver Callan Musings Monologue Highlights. Oh yes. So, you know what day it is today, right? That's right, it's Tick Awareness Day. Because, of course it is. Same time every year. To celebrate, if that's the right word, the day that's in it, Claire Byrne was joined this morning by Dr. Paul McKeown, consultant in public health medicine with HSE National Health Protection. Paul dove straight in with what makes ticks tick.
Ticks are they're tiny spider-like creatures, and they feed on blood. They're extremely small, kind of puppy size, and they're found everywhere, really, in the country. They especially like grasses. So the kind of places where they're found are in undergrowth. So individuals who might be at increased risk would be ramblers, campers, mountain bikers, people who work or walk or out about in areas such as woodland, parkland and heathland. However, although they're much commoner in rural areas, they're also found in city areas. And this is the time of year in which they become most active and most common. So from really March right the way through to October is when we see most of them.
And there's no reason why we're more concerned about them now than we might have been in the past, is there?
No. Well, we're concerned about them because they can carry certain diseases. One disease in particular, Lyme disease, and I'll come back to that. But all the indications, we've been monitoring ticks and Lyme disease for a number of years now. The levels are fairly steady and the amount of Lyme disease we're seeing is at about the same level that it's been for the past few years. But these are climate sensitive creatures and that could change and is likely to change with climate change.
OK, so let's talk about Lyme disease then, because I think a lot of people who grew up in Ireland running around, you know, in their shorts in the summertime, maybe don't know about the danger of ticks and what can happen.
Exactly. I mean, Lyme disease, it's caused by a bacterium called Borrelia. And Lyme disease is as a result of a bite from an infected tick. Now, only a minority of ticks, perhaps 5% of ticks in Ireland and in the UK, are infected. Lyme disease, there's a range of symptoms from no symptoms. You know, probably a handful of percent of people in the country will have had a tick bite at some stage in their lives and will never have had any symptoms. So a lot of people don't get any symptoms.
So you wouldn't even know you've been bitten by a tick.
You wouldn't even know. The commonest symptom, if you develop, if you catch Lyme disease, the commonest symptom is a thing called a bullseye rash. And about a half to a third of patients get these. And they develop between 3 and 30 days after the bite. Having said that, the number of those kind of cases in the country, we don't count those, we count more severe cases, but it's likely to be very low, 250, maybe up to 500, perhaps more, we just don't know. But it's not a terribly common disease, but the same as salmonella, much less commoner than flu or COVID. Mm-hmm. This form and all forms of Lyme disease, however, are readily treated by antibiotics. There are more severe forms which can involve the heart, joint and central nervous system, and they require specialist hospital treatment. And one of the reasons we're putting out this advice is, A, avoid tick bites. That's the best way to avoid getting Lyme disease. If you do get it, if you get the symptoms, and all information that you need can be found on our website, and you'll get there by Googling HPSC Lyme. All the information on how to protect yourself is there, and also the symptoms of Lyme disease so that you know when to go to your GP and he can then prescribe antibiotics.
So the first thing you're going to notice is this bullseye rash. Is that at the site of the bite?
As I say, up to half people don't, up to 50% of people actually don't develop this, and they can develop other symptoms, but that's the commonest symptom. That okay. develops at the site of the bite. So if you have a bite, often there's just irritation and a bit of swelling. But after 3 or 4 days, this characteristic rash, it's called a bullseye rash because it's red, red circle in the middle, and then classically a paler area around it, then a paler circle or darker red circle around that, like a bullseye. And that is the classical symptom. And if a GP sees that, he has enough to begin treatment with antibiotics because he knows it's Lyme disease.
So, and you will only experience these symptoms of Lyme disease if you're bitten by a tick infected by Borrelia. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
But a tick not infected by Borrelia is unlikely to impact your health at all, really.
Won't at all. Just irritation. And the thing about them is they're so small. It's not like a horsefly or something like that. You will not feel this bite. They are very delicate. What they do is they feed on blood. They love undergrowth. And whenever they want to feed, they go what's called questing. They climb up the fronds of grasses because they want to latch on to a host, something with blood, maybe a deer, maybe a sheep, maybe a person. They will hang on the end, and whenever the host goes past, they will attach on. And after a long period of time, they'll start to feed. So if you find a tick in yourself after you've been out walking, it's very unlikely that tick has actually started to feed. And it's only when it starts to feed, when it bites and starts to suck blood, that the infection can be passed.
Mm.
So in general, for at least 12, minimum of 12, and probably as many as 24 hours, there won't be any risk of it being passed on.
But it's under your skin at that point, is it?
The tick attaches to the skin. So they're poppy size. And what they do is they latch on, bite deeply and start sucking.
Lovely. And how do you get these things out then? Because the advice is to remove them, isn't it?
But that's right. The advice is to remove them. And you can use, as soon as you see a tick, or certainly when you get home, if you see a tick, it should be removed. Now, ticks tend to attach on adult humans, we're talking about here, on the legs and arms. It's different for kids. They prefer to attach around the head. So whenever you're checking yourself, check your arms, legs, but also check your whole body because they can attach elsewhere, less likely with children. Head, neck, hairline is where these tend to attach. If you see it, remove it straight away. There's a tick removal tool. And all the information is at HPSC, Google HPSC Lyme. You'll find it all there. But you can get tick removal tools in a chemist or a fine tip tweezers to help you lift it out, and then you clean the bite. What you do then is you check that bite over the next few days and expect a bit of itching and swelling. And if a rash develops, that's the time to contact your GP.
Mm-hmm. That's when you might need the course of antibiotics. And you've got to be careful when you're removing it that you get the entire tick and don't leave a bit of him behind.
Absolutely, because if you leave a bit of the mouth parts behind, it can still go on passing infection.
Oh,
exactly right.
Horrible little things, aren't they? So listen, tell me, you want people to cover up and not get bitten in the first place. That's the advice.
Exactly. Prevention is always better than cure. So what we're advising is, and again, I said at the top of the interview, please don't go away from this thinking, oh, this is another thing for me to worry about. Simple protection. So because they like grass, stay as far as possible to the middle of trails and paths, avoid undergrowth. Wear hat, shoes, long sleeves. DEET or an equivalent repellent, insect repellent from your chemist. Spray on clothes and skin. And then check yourself and your kids during the day and when you get home.
Oh God, it's also unpleasant. Let's just stay in this summer. What do you say? Stay in with complete body covering outfits on, like failed superheroes. Anyway, that was Dr. Paul McKeown from HSE National Health Protection talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the lovely ticks we can expect to pluck from our limbs in the great outdoors this season. For the day that's in it, Katie Hannan spoke to Clodagh on this afternoon's Liveline about what people get up to and what they used to get up to on May Day.
I believe you were out washing your face in morning dew this morning.
Well, I just put my hand on the grass. I was waiting on my son to get out of the house, so I said, right, I might as well go over, touch this grass and put it on my face.
Well, we did hear from somebody else who we were trying to coax them to come on and tell us the story, but they were out this morning full buck naked, rolling around in their garden in the grass because they said that's what they do every May morning, every May Day morning.
So, kind of a dangerous hobby.
Clodagh, you know all about this. You're the keeper of the Irish folklore collection in the National Museum. Yeah. So, what is the overall, like, why, first of all, is May Day so special? Just to give people that perspective, yeah.
Really quickly, I suppose it's one of the quarter days. So it's one of the four days that start a season. So Bridget's Day or Imbolc is the start of spring, and then it's the 1st of May for Bealtaine, and then it's Lunasa, the 1st of August, for the harvest festival in autumn, and then the 1st of November is the start of winter. But with all of the festivals that you kind of know, like 1st of November, the start of winter, it's usually the night before. So actually a lot of traditions would have happened between last night and this morning. So most people would have been really cautious around May time, because Bealtaine was a time of lots of superstition. But there's always superstition around those 4 days, because you're kind of not quite in one season and you've not quite left the other season. So there's a sort of a limbo time, and people always felt that the other world, the supernatural world, the fairies, everything else was quite close at hand. And it was also a time for foretelling the future, but protecting yourself from any evil influences, especially the evil eye.
Well, yeah, that's what struck me, is that a lot of the evil influences you were trying to protect yourself from seemed to be your next door neighbour.
And
there was so this is like the idea of pishogues and people, you know, having association with pishogue. Carry on. Tell us, what were the kind of worries that people had that might happen around this time of year?
Well, you've only just probably... Everyone's living off the land, I suppose, in the past. And also, without electricity, you know, the land can be a different place, you know, and nighttime can be a different place. But there's always belief that there's people with malintent that might be going from place to place. But certainly, people worried about their butter and the butter yield. So really they were worried about anyone looking at the churn, looking at their cow, looking at their butter. And if they look with a bit of envy, then maybe the butter wouldn't come anymore and that the cow would fall sick. So it was a real time to make sure that people wouldn't look with the evil eye and look with envy on something you have. And if you had, and you really tried to protect your water in your well, and you might put lovely flowers down there so that nobody can touch it. But you also just need to protect the cattle. You might tie some red ribbons and rowan rings on them, on their tails.
One of our team was saying that they remembered rowan being tied to cattle's tails. What's the significance of rowan?
Just the look. It's just everything would be about red is protection, rowan protection. It's all this idea of a ring of protection as well, a rowan ring. And it's kind of a very pliable little kind of piece of wood. So you might be able to make a little ring and then that becomes protection. So circles are protection. Red ribbon. But the idea of red and protection, a bit like the brass breeger you might leave out on the windowsill, often a piece of red ribbon or a ribbing breeger. So everything is, sometimes red comes up a lot as protective colour. But you might put irons in the fire or even a horseshoe under the churn or in the churn. So your protection is always there, you know, from different ways.
And in terms of when you say the evil eye, like how did were there particular people that were known to have the evil eye, or could anyone turn up with an evil eye? And could you take
yes. There were actually people who were known, and in folklore collecting, they collected it and realised that there were people who had the evil eye and were known to everybody. And a bit like maybe the Queen or somebody going ahead, when anyone saw that this person was coming down the street, they put the child into the house, the cow into the byre. They kind of got rid of everything in their sight so that they would make sure that person couldn't look at them. Because if they looked at the child or the child might fall sick. But it was these people, anyone born on Whit weekend was often believed to have the evil eye. I am very unlucky. And
that seems to be very unfair, unfortunate
yes,
situation.
Unfortunate. You're,
by accident of birth on Whit Weekend, which is of course the first weekend in June.
Yeah.
That was very inauspicious. If you happen
yeah.
to,
but you were able to protect the child from having the evil eye by getting a evil out of them. So the, you know how babies will clasp something really tightly in their hands, because that instinct. So they'd often put a worm or something in the baby's hand so that it killed something and it. And all the evil was gone out of the child then. So there you go.
So something alive that would die in a child's hand.
Yes, in the clenched hand. But, I mean, people did believe that, you know, you could look with envy. Anyone could look with envy. But people, you know, the evil eye was very prevalent around now. And people think, like, you know, protection, we didn't have the same as in Greece and in Turkey, like eye-shaped protection, you know, and charms.
I was just going to say, yeah, so is that international then? Because obviously anybody who's yeah. ever been to Greece or that part of the world will know all the jewellery and all the iconography around the evil eye and that protection thing. So it's an international notion then, this idea.
It is, definitely. You know, it's the idea of envy, really, I suppose, and a malevolent kind of glance of the eye. And then as a result, you can't put your finger on it, but you realise, yeah, my unbaptised child is sick or something like that. And there's a sense that, you know, a barren woman has looked at the child. You know, there's a sense that, you know, people will look and they mightn't even have envy. They mightn't realise they have the evil eye, but the child falls sick or the cow, that's a fine cow, and then the cow is suddenly very ill, you know, or that's lovely butter you have there. Or, you know, you might come into a house, you should say, God bless the work if anyone was churning, because then at least you've added a prayer so that even if you have the evil eye, you've said the prayer afterwards, God bless, and then it should be all okay.
Who knew? The intricacies that people get up to on May Day, as discussed by folklorist Clodagh on this afternoon's Live Line with Katie Hannan. Tom Moran is a big, fat, filthy, disgusting liar. That's not a statement, by the way. That's actually the title of a one-man show which is running in the Abbey Theatre for most of May. And the one man doing that show? Why? Tom Moran, of course. Tom dropped into the radio centre this morning to talk to Oliver Callan. Just don't believe anything he says, obviously.
We start with the childhood lies. It's a show about lying, obviously, as the title suggests. You're 11 years of age. Where are you and what's going on in your life?
Yeah, so I was in school and like loads of kids, I hadn't done my homework one day. Okay. And I was afraid of this particular teacher and I didn't want to come clean. So, you know, like loads of kids and like I regularly did, I faked being sick to get the day off school.
Yeah.
And I picked a sore tummy because, you know, there was no scopes. They couldn't look in the ears or up the nose, anything like that.
Oh, you had it all thought out.
Oh, I had it down to a T. Yep. But on this particular day, you know, the doctor's kind of poking and prodding at my tummy. But the spot that he hits that I choose to kind of wince at, it turned out to be my appendix. So I was sent to the hospital, you know, for all these ultrasounds and all this sort of stuff. So in the car, I'm like, oh, I presume, you know, a scan is going to show I'm fine and they'll just send me
home.
You're
going to have to go.
Exactly. It'll be like, a miscommunication. It'll all be fine. But I was quite a heavy child. And so the ultrasound actually wouldn't work, as in it couldn't see through like the flab in my tummy.
Right.
So then they didn't know what was wrong and they were like, well, the spot where your pain is totally consistent with appendicitis and we really don't want it to burst. So to be on the safe side, we'll take it out. So I get this land and I'm like, but there's nothing wrong with my appendix. I'm totally fine. But I'm also in too deep at this point. And so I just let them take it out. And more to the point, I didn't tell anyone for about 20 years.
Oh my God. And at no point are you thinking along the way, like, for example, on the way to hospital, that maybe I should come clean?
Oh, the whole way. But I mean, that is the extent of my people pleasing. And I didn't want to get in trouble. It was all that very like childish stuff. If I didn't want to, you know, disappoint my parents, I didn't want to, you know, be a bad kid in school. So the easier option just lay under the knife.
Oh my God. And it takes you 20 years to finally tell the truth. So in the interim of those 20 years, are you a kind of a habitual liar?
Like, it's kind of lying in that way of, I think when I was a child, I definitely told a lot of lies. But then when I grew into my like late teens, my 20s, I think it kind of evolved to not necessarily be outright lies, although there were lies, but I'd kind of describe it as like living out of truth. You know what I mean? So kind of not behaving like with loads of integrity or in a way that, you know, in your better moments, you'd stand over and kind of realizing as you got older, like, I don't like that, and I don't like that version of me, and how do I ultimately stop doing it?
So why are you telling all these fibs?
Well, so I have a theory that human beings only lie in the presence of shame. So if you want to stop lying, you've got to exercise the source of that shame. And ultimately, I mean, there's a whole journey there, and it's very much dealt with in the play, but ultimately, that's kind of what I did over the course of, you know, a number of years through therapy, through kind of, you know, conversations with my parents, and just through a lot of self-reflection. And ultimately the play is kind of a crescendo of that journey, in trying to like sort of exercise that shame, you know, in front of a live audience over like 70 odd minutes.
Yeah, it's interesting because particularly that lie you tell when you're 11 years old, you end up getting your appendix removed for no reason, as it turned out, in the end, other than your own lies. You're the only person being harmed by the lies.
Yeah, which I think is often the way. Because we...
Is that how it was then for your teenage years in the family?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, because I think a lot of the time lying isn't necessarily self-protective. It can sometimes be like to protect the people around you, or you think you're protecting the people around you. But as you said, like often we are the collateral damage of our own stories and our own lies. And in my case, I think that was certainly true.
Tell us about then, you know, your life. You're coming from a normal, steady, happy family.
Yeah.
In many ways. In Dunboyne, is that where you grew up?
That's
in,
right, yeah.
In County Meath. So tell us about your
growing
up.
Probably a really conventional Irish childhood in lots of ways. Like very happy, you know, great memories. Mom, dad, two younger brothers. Would have, you know, done quite well in school. Like that, I would have been a bit of a goody two shoes, a teacher's pet, all that stuff. But like equally then would have grown into secondary school and, you know, done a lot of like the school musicals and been in a band and student council, you know, a lot of that stuff. There was probably like a lot of sort of like a real achiever in me that I think always wanted to be perceived as like, you know, a good guy, a good person, but like absolutely a really, really happy childhood.
Did you find out looking back that as a child you were trying to please your mum?
Yeah, I think so. Like, you know, growing up, like loads of parents, mum would have had struggles at various times. And I suppose as a little kid, I didn't really understand that because you don't when you're young. And I think like, kids have a tendency when there's something going on in their lives, you know, as much of a kind of coping mechanism, like looking for control, they just sort of look at themselves being like, well, what can I do to make everything okay? And now, you know, I'm very happy to speak about that, as is my mom. Like I have access to this information that I didn't as a kid. But at the time, I kind of just thought when stuff was going on with my mom, like she was angry or stressed or upset, it was my fault. And I think in the world, I would go out and try to hyper-achieve and people-please as like evidence to be like, but look, I'm all right and everyone else thinks I'm okay, so maybe you guys will too.
What were you kind of doing to please her?
I think it was a lot of that stuff about, you know, shining in like parent-teacher meetings, you know, being a pleasure to teach. And yeah, all that stuff about trying to, you know, be on the student council. Can I be student of the year? Can I be in the firsts in football? All of that stuff, like kind of wherever I could get little gleams of affirmation from outside the house and bring them back in like a little magpie, you know, almost for approval. Yeah. It was a lot of that sort of stuff.
So you said there were issues with your mum, and we could talk about, I know she's not here, so it feels strange to say that. I mean, She's still alive, obviously, is what I mean, but she's not with us in this conversation. But you said there's information you discover later that you didn't have as a child that kind of explained, the relationship that you had.
Yeah, so my mom was adopted when she was a little girl. And, you know, I think that was probably something that would have been back in the 60s. And obviously, just as we know with Ireland and the way so much of that was handled, it was far from ideal.
Of course,
there was a lot of, you know, trauma and a lack of understanding about what that was and what the ramifications of that would be. And I think my mom would feel that a lot of that trauma wasn't really processed or even fully felt until she became a mother herself. And so I was the firstborn child in our house. And I think my birth like awoke just this real like tumult in my mom, and just what led to, and you know, also being a mom to three kids, like that's a lot. And yeah. as a kid, I was a lot. So, you know, a combination of all those things could just lead to, you know, the house sometimes being an unpredictable place and at times a scary place. And yeah, and as a little kid, again, I didn't really understand, and I don't think my mom understood, that that was kind of a function of like this larger trauma. And yeah, so we were all kind of muddling along.
She was angry.
She was angry. Yeah, I think she was lots of things. And it's worth saying at this point that I think the reason I'm able to tell this story is that my mom is the most amazing person and has since gone on to become a therapist and right. specializes with like adolescents and, you know, and a lot of kids who have been adopted, Irish kids, kids from all over the world who've come here and, you know, in an amazing way is able to use her experience to understand them in a way that very few people can. So I'm incredibly lucky that my mom has kind of taken that pain and turned it into this really beautiful mechanism for healing for other people. And, you know, in a funny way, I think that that's me making my play is like my, you know, far less meaningful version of doing the same thing.
That's actor and writer, or so he says, Tom Moran, talking to Oliver Callan this morning about his show Tom Moran is a Big Fat Filthy Disgusting Liar, which is now running at the Abbey Theatre. The price of coffee, much like everything else, is going up. Again. RTE's business guy Adam Maguire joined Clare Byrne this morning to explain why we're paying more and more for our favourite hot beverage.
If we look at the coffee category in the Central Statistics Office Consumer Price Index, we see that the prices are around 16% higher as of March of this year compared to March of 2020. That coffee price, so from the CSO, it's the coffee you'd pick up in your weekly shop. So it wouldn't include what you'd buy in a cafe. There's no real official date on that because it would be buried in the CSO stats on restaurants and hotels, which obviously includes loads of other things. So it's kind of impossible to pull out the coffee only change. What we can do, or the best thing we can do really as a kind of shorthand, is to look at the prices in specific coffee places in 2020 and compare them to where they are now. I managed to find the price list for two of the big coffee chains and can use them as kind of representatives. So Starbucks and Costa Coffee, two of the big kind of multinational chains that operate here. Starbucks, for example, a large Americano now close to 19% more expensive than it was in 2020. A large cappuccino is about 16.5% dearer. A large mocha is 18.6% more expensive. A large mocha is actually now past the €6 threshold. And like I always
€6?
Yeah, I always think of, you know, €4 kind of, God, that's very expensive for coffee.
I don't buy mochas now. I don't even know what they are.
Now, Americano would still be the cheaper the lot, but that's more than four. I think it's $4.50 in Starbucks now. So it has gotten a lot more expensive. Costa, a large Americano, 23% dearer. It is, though, still cheaper than the Starbucks equivalent. Large cappuccino, similar price rise there. But it is really difficult, though, to give a short answer to the question, how much dearer is coffee? Because really, coffee isn't one thing. It's actually multiple products and multiple different markets that are being served.
Yeah, well, we all know, I mean, your Americano was a price beginning with a 2 and now it's a price beginning with a 3. So we can
Or a 4, even.
Or a 4. Well, I wouldn't be buying it if it started with a 4. That's too much. Now, coffee is multiple products because there are different varieties. So
that's
will
right,
you explain how all of this works?
Yeah, so essentially, there are two varieties of coffee that we consume. There's Robusta coffee beans and Arabica coffee beans. Vietnam is the world's biggest producer of Robusta. Brazil is the biggest producer of Arabica. And generally speaking, Robusta is the cheaper type of coffee and it's the one that's usually used in the production of instant coffee. Arabica is what's the favoured one for fresh coffee, for brewed coffee. And even then within that, there would be different grades of Arabica. So your artisanal producer is going to be seeking out a very specific type of Arabica. You may be going to a particular country or a particular farm to get the exact thing they want compared to maybe a mass market producer that might just take kind of whatever is cheapest or whatever is available to them. And the price they pay per kilo is going to differ as a result of that. But we can kind of get a broad sense of how prices have shifted in recent years through the commodities markets where coffee futures are bought and sold. So if you look at what's called the US Coffee C Futures, which covers the Arabica trade, we can see that back at the start of May 2020, buyers were paying somewhere in the low to mid 90 cent per pound for Arabica coffee. Sometimes it actually fell as low as the kind of mid to high 80 cent range. Today, the price is around $2.23 per pound. So
that's a huge
130% increase over the course of 4 years. Now, there's a lot of volatility within that. It goes up and down. It's been much higher than 2.23. It's also fallen into the kind of 150 range at times as well. But the trend absolutely on the up in terms of the price over the last 4 years.
OK, and then the type that you mentioned that's used in instant coffee.
Yeah, Robusta. Robusta. So there's a different market for that. That's the London Robusta coffee future. So it's priced in sterling. And just to confuse things even further, it's priced per metric ton rather than per pound. So different prices. But here we see the upward trend is even clearer. Robusta was priced at around £1,250 per metric ton back in May 2020. Today it's around £4,150 per metric ton. So a tripling of the price over 4 years. And what that tells us is that, you know, as much as coffee has actually gone up here for consumers, it's not actually as severe as what's happening at the kind of market, the source end of it. So to some extent, the people along the chain are maybe cutting their costs or trying to absorb some of that into their margin to keep the price down. But bear in mind, these are also future markets. So the price that people are paying now on the futures markets are for coffee that gets delivered in months' time, maybe. So some of what we're seeing in the price rises there will come down the tracks. It just hasn't hit us
yet.
That's
for us to look forward to, in
exactly,
other words.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is impacting those price rises then?
Weather is one of the big factors. So Brazil's harvest was badly hit back in 2020 and 2021 by a combination of harsh drought, which impacted the coffee plant's ability to actually grow seeds in the first place. And then there was a freak frost that also damaged crops. And if you go back to that futures market, you see the price of Arabica futures climbed rapidly from early 2021 onwards as people involved tried to digest the knock-on effect of the world's biggest producer being so badly hit. Now, output from Brazil has bounced back to a large extent. The country is expecting its third increase in production in a row this year, which is actually quite unusual given the way Arabica tends to grow. But things were so bad back in 2020 and 2021, it isn't enough to make up for what we saw a couple of years ago. For example, global inventories of coffee were so badly hit by that shortfall, they're still at decades-long lows. So they haven't recovered basically that stock of coffee that would have been in the market. If you look on the Robusta side, then Vietnam, which, as I said, was the biggest producer of that type of coffee, has been experiencing hotter than normal weather at the moment. It was exacerbated by El Nino last year. It continues now. Some areas are in the midst of a month-long heat wave. Robusta, as the name suggests, is a more robust plant. It's meant to kind of do better in kind of severe weather, but it still suffered quite a lot. And as a result, we're likely to see a fall in production. We already have seen a fall in production from Vietnam. And that explains why, if you look at the markets there in recent months, the futures market is up about 90% since October 2023. So in a very short period of time, the price of Robusta coffee has really jumped. It's gotten so expensive that, as I say, it's usually the cheaper option. Some Robusta buyers are actually buying now low-grade Arabica instead because that's cheaper than Robusta.
Okay.
And that then has a knock-on effect on everything. It pushes the price all the way up the market then.
Okay, so you've gone through some of the weather events then that have affected these price rises. Is it just the weather then that's at play?
No, like that is a big factor, but it's not the only thing. So the higher energy prices that we all know about will, of course, have a knock-on effect because it costs more to roast the coffee and then the cost of actually shipping it halfway around the world as well. And shipping itself has gotten more expensive, not just because of fuel costs, but because of the multiple rounds of disruption we've had in shipping in the last 4 years. COVID led to a huge logjam, which took a long time to unwind. Then we had the Ever Given blocking the Suez Canal, the recent attacks on ships in the Red Sea, which has led shipping companies to reroute some on longer, slower and more expensive routes. And that mightn't have affected, say, what's coming from Brazil, because it wouldn't necessarily go through the Suez Canal, but it would have impacted shipments from the likes of Vietnam. And it all has a knock-on effect.
Lousy knock-on effect. That's business reporter Adam Maguire telling us how much more we're paying for our coffee these days on This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne. On this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show, Ray was joined by Slovakian violinists and brothers Vladimir and Anton, with Shane on keyboards, to talk about their show at the Bordgosh Energy Theatre. It's their take on Vivaldi's Four Seasons.
When they say your take, what's your take on it?
My take is explaining it. The title is Four Seasons Explained. It's based pretty much on Vivaldi. Music is changed very little. But what we did, we added up the more contemporary instruments into it. In saying contemporary, not like electronic, but we brought instruments that perhaps didn't exist at a time when Vivaldi
wrote
it.
Like electric guitar?
Like, look, you have a Storm, for example, yes, in one of the movements. And before they were only explaining it with fast bowing.
Yes.
Because it's only string orchestra, but we added thunder sheet, yes. Massive 2 meters, you know, sheet. We have wind machine. We have... We added also wind
so
and brass
it's
and
a
lot of percussion.
Full orchestra yourself.
Full orchestra.
Yes.
So it sounds much more like a movie.
Right.
And then, of course, a big part of this is also the production, which is already changed third time. Last year, I did something I thought is amazing. I looked back to 25,000 out the window euros.
Right. So this is bigger. This is bigger.
This is bigger. And also, we are adding now really, really cool visuals. I think I found the artist I was looking for years.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's why I said this is the third version. And it's months and months of work. And we are timing the lights exactly with it as well.
Brilliant.
Now, this is the first part of the show. What you heard now, this is the fun part, the second part of the concert.
So you're doing cover versions of contemporary music?
Also, yes. The Four Seasons is basically Vivaldi's.
See, I want
seasons.
To see it in 5 years' time because you're going to have rain. You're going to do Vivaldi. You're going to have rain. You're going to have the whole thing.
Yes.
The whole
thing. It's coming there. We already have people coming from abroad, actually, promoters trying to get
dress
it.
Dress appropriately. You'll have to say dress appropriately. Bring rain gear. Yeah, that'd be great.
Oh, no,
wouldn't
it?
Yeah.
Thank you for the idea.
So, Anton, you still live in mainland Europe. And,
yes.
And Vladimir, you're resident here.
Yes, I am indeed.
Why didn't you move to Ireland, Anton? Just liked it better in Europe?
I like the weather
yes.
I live close to the Italian border. I live in Switzerland.
Nice.
And my wife is also from there, so I cannot move. She doesn't want.
Yes. And do you make a living playing the violin over there? Yes.
I'm trying my best.
Yes. But there's something, and I know when you meet siblings who sing together, that there's an understanding and there's a harmony. And I can see between you two as well, there's an understanding there. Is there also competition?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
A different kind of competition.
Because you were doing your separate parts there and, you know, Vladimir coming in and then it sort of put it up to you to go, but yeah.
No, it's helping us to improve.
Yes, yes.
I mean, we grew up six siblings, out of which five of us are full-time musicians, like the youngest
all
brother.
All violinists, sir?
Four violinists? No. No, it was four. Now it's only three because Victor went conducting. He finished the master's in that. And he actually arranged the Four Seasons. He's conducting it as well in May. And then we have Aldo's brother violin, sister is piano player. Now we meet in Triarina always every year there. Now we moved it from the small.
And you've been here how long?
19 years.
19
Longer
years.
Than I was in Slovakia.
Yeah, yeah. Go back up there because we want you to play out. I know that was a short chat, but...
it was a good chat.
Let the music do the talk, and I'll remind people that it's Friday and Saturday, May 24th and 25th. That's a few weeks' time. It's in Borgosh Energy Theatre. Tickets are available now. And it's Vladimir's take on Vivaldi with Wind Machine, the Four Seasons Wind Machine, and what's the Thunder?
Thunder Sheet.
Thunder Sheet. And now they're going to play, and this is the second half of the concert. You'll hear things like this. Those were the days.
My friend. Thank you.
Those Were the Days, performed live by virtuoso violinists Vladimir and Anton, with Shane on keyboards, on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, the contentious topic of vaping, and especially the availability of vapes and vaping products in the vicinity of schools. On this morning's Today with Claire Byrne, Professor Des Cox, consultant in paediatric respiratory medicine at CHI Crumlin, and Joe Dunn, director of Hale Vaping, Ireland's largest retailer and distributor of vaping products, joined Claire to discuss the whole topic, and Des gave a description of the effects of vaping on the younger patients that he treats.
We've seen across the country an increase in the use of vaping amongst both teenagers and young people. So approximately 4 or 10 16-year-olds have tried vaping, and about 15% of them using regularly. So we know that from research and again from my own clinical practice is that, you know, and from my paediatric colleagues, is that nicotine is a highly addictive substance, and exposure to it can lead to different health impacts. So for example, in the adolescent brain, it can affect cognition, lead to mood disorders, irritability and sleep issues. Then from a respiratory perspective, certainly I've seen people who vape come in with asthma symptoms, increased cough, bronchitis type symptoms. And then down the track, the concern about vaping is that there is some evidence that there is an increased risk of cardiac and lung disease in later life. And I suppose the other concern that we would have as paediatricians is that adolescents who vape are about 4 times more likely to start smoking. So again, putting them in harm's way of developing a habit.
Notwithstanding all of that, is there a timeline issue here with seeing the effects of vaping? Is it that we just don't know yet what the long-term impact will be?
Well, we're starting to get more evidence on that. And, for instance, a recent New England Journal of Medicine paper reported that there is lung disease and cardiovascular disease associated with vaping. When they looked at people who dual used both e-cigarettes and smoking, and that there was a different, it probably results in a different type of disease. So not necessarily lung cancer and things like that, but other types of chronic bronchitis and COPD-like symptoms down the track. But we are starting to get that evidence now. But as you already say, it was probably about 20 years before we actually found out the real harms of tobacco. It took us a long time to get that information.
So you want to see a radius around schools where there would be no vaping shops allowed?
Yeah, well, so if you think about it, the evidence from tobacco control research would show that, where tobacco retailers were restricted around schools, it resulted in less teenagers smoking. And that's, the rationale behind that is because it's ease of access. So if you can't access these products, at the drop of a hat, then obviously it can help decrease the prevalence of teenagers using the products. So, and we know that tobacco companies in the past targeted the market with advertising and marketing, especially in shops around schools and things like that. So that we know that now. So what we feel is happening now is that a similar pattern is developing. So when you walk into a garage, a corner shop, a convenience store, or whatever you want to call it, you can see that the vapes are front and center on the counter. They're colourful. There's advertisements there in front of us. So teenagers are being constantly bombarded with this, not only at the counter, but also on social media and things like that. So if you had a system where people couldn't sell vaping products in or around schools, then it would make the teenagers and less likely to take up the habit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's come to Joe and see what Joe thinks about this. So, Joe, you'd have a radius around schools where you just couldn't sell vapes. Do you think that might work?
I don't think so, Claire. I think we need to look at a few things. The first thing that I would say, and my company would say, and the vape industry, is that any young person should not be smoking or vaping. That's the bottom line. And anybody who's not a smoker shouldn't take up vaping. So that's a very strong stance that we have. When you look at vape shops or places selling vape products near schools, that's not going to make a difference. If you really look at the people who are selling these products, like vape shops and like FMCG, they're used to dealing with age-restricted products. So if you look at garages or your corner shop, they're used to dealing with tobacco and alcohol. So they're well used to doing age checks and everything else. So I don't think that is really the issue. I do agree with Des Cox in relation to that we could tighten up the regulations or make it harder for young people to get them. And I think one of the main things that could do that, along with the bans under 18s, which has come into law this year, would be to tighten up on the licensing system, which hasn't been actually developed or put into place yet.
Yeah, so we were promised that, weren't we, that there would be a licensing scheme where shops would have to pay 2,000 for a license to sell. But that hasn't come in yet, has it?
No, it hasn't come in yet. And as far as I know, they're just trying to work out the best way to set that up. But you're right, there needs to be more deterrence. And I think my personal opinion, and I've been in the industry over 12 years now, is that you can readily avail of these products in too many locations. So I think it's an ideal opportunity for the government to look at the licensing system and to restrict it to vape shops who are specialists in this category, like who are specialists in ensuring that young people don't use them, and also just have it in places where tobacco and alcohol are sold, Claire, because they are used to doing that for so many years.
Restricted to people like you, Joe, is what you're saying.
Well, not to me, Claire. Claire, if you look at my company, we have AI facial recognition screens gone into our stores now. We really take this seriously. Like, we don't mess around. We are very strict. If you don't smoke, don't vape. If you're a young person, don't smoke or vape either. We just put these AI screens into some of our stores on a test run, and we're going to roll it out into all our stores because we do not believe that young people should be vaping. So I do agree with Des Cox on that.
That's Joe Dunn, director with Hale Vaping, Ireland's largest retailer and distributor of vaping products, who, along with Des Cox, consultant in paediatric respiratory medicine at CHI Crumlin, joined Claire Byrne this morning to talk about the availability of vapes and vaping products, especially in the vicinity of schools. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. I'll be back with another dose of Evil Eyes tomorrow. Until then, thank you for listening and good luck.